Well, welcome to the tape. We're about 600 AD, I'm afraid. So the Anglo-Saxons come in. They create a number of kingdoms, and these kingdoms gradually solidify from around about 600 AD to 800 AD. And there, I've given you a map too. That's the Anglo-Saxon kingdoms in 800 AD. If you remember history from school painfully because you were taught about the Heptarchy. No, this is the Heptarchy. Seven kingdoms: Northumbria, Mercia, Wessex, East Anglia, Essex, Kent, and Sussex. Again, why some small, some large? Partly an accident of history. It partly also reflects that those southern and eastern counties would be more heavily populated. Those areas, those kingdoms, would be more heavily populated than the more northern and western kingdoms. Also, Mercia is an 8th century expansion across into places like Chester and as far as Offa's Dyke. Offa is the most powerful king of Mercia. He builds Offa's Dyke in the late 8th century. So that's the kind of spread, that's the kind of situation you've got. That's what Britain looks like in this period. Notice that whilst you can sort of detect a Welsh border roughly at Offa's Dyke, there isn't a Scottish border in the way that there is now. Northumbria would go all the way up to the Firth of Forth, which is, of course, the more natural barrier, frankly. And Strathclyde, which is a sort of British kingdom, really, would come all the way down to... what's that river? It's Ribble. Is that the Ribble? I think it comes down to the Ribble. Yeah. And obviously, so there we are. So you can see slightly different to what you have now, and you can see the influence of mountains and lowland in that. That's by way of introduction. That's what you've got in terms of the Anglo-Saxon kingdoms. Once those kingdoms are spread across in 600 AD, you have a country which has been de-Christianized. That is, they are pagan tribes. Okay, and therefore, from the end of the 6th century, you get this process of reconversion or Christianization of these pagan tribes. And that comes from two directions. Okay, the first is from the south, and this is Gregory the Great's mission in 597 AD. We met Gregory the First last week, Gregory the First, Pope Gregory the First. He is a spiritual leader in Rome, of course, Bishop of Rome, but he also has considerable temporal authority. He's one of the people trying to hold Rome together. There's been no emperor in the West since 476, so for over 100 years. There are various tribes that are threatening the peace in Italy, Lombards being one of them. They will ultimately settle in that part of the world. In the midst of that, he receives some Angles at his court in Rome. These Angles were a Germanic tribe, and therefore we're to picture them as the classic Germanic tribes as being fair-skinned and blonde-haired. And do you know the story? He said that they are not Angles, but... Yeah, probably didn't, but anyway, that's the story. And this was the start of the mission into Britain. Now, of course, these events are always telegraphed in the source, telescoped in the sources, so that various of the other things that are going on aren't recorded. And we'll see when we come to the extract that I'm about to read, you can see that there's other stuff going on as well. But basically, that mission lands in Kent for various reasons. At that time, the king of Kent, Ethelbert, is Bretwell. That is, he's the most powerful of the Anglo-Saxon kings. And therefore, in some sense or other, the other seven kingdoms are owing him some kind of authority. It's a little bit, I am being very deliberately quite vague about that because I'm not exactly sure how it worked. But he sends Augustine, who's a monk, to re-Christianize the country. Okay? With us so far? And this, here we get, therefore, to Augustine coming into Britain. So this is an extract from the Venerable Bede's Ecclesiastical History of the English People. We'll come back to Bede a little bit later. And you can see the date for this, 597 AD. Augustine, thus strengthened by the encouragement of the Blessed Father Gregory, returned to the work of the Word of God with the servants of Christ who were with him and arrived in Britain. The powerful Ethelbert was at that time king of Kent. He had extended his dominions as far as the boundary formed by the great river Humber, by which the southern Saxons are divided from the northern. On the east of Kent is the large Isle of Thanet, containing, according to the English way of reckoning, 600 families, divided from the mainland by the river Wansum, which is about 3 furlongs in breadth, and which can be crossed only in 2 places, for at both ends it runs into the sea. On this island landed the servant of the Lord Augustine and his companions, being, as it is reported, nearly 40 men. They had obtained, by order of the blessed Pope Gregory, interpreters of the nation of the Franks, and sending to Ethelbert, signified that they were come from Rome and brought a joyful message, which most undoubtedly assured to those who hearkened to it everlasting joys in heaven and a kingdom that would never end, with the living and true God. The king, hearing this, gave orders that they should stay in the island where they had landed and be furnished with necessities till he should consider what to do with them. For he had before heard of the Christian religion, having a Christian wife of the royal family of the Franks called Bertha, whom he had received from her parents, upon condition that she should be permitted to preserve inviolate the rites of her religion with the bishop Leudhard, who was sent with her to support her in the faith. Some days after, the king came into the island, and sitting in the open air, ordered Augustine and his companions to come and hold a conference with him. For he had taken precaution that they should not come to him in any house, lest by so coming, according to an ancient superstition, if they practised any magical arts, they might impose upon him, and so get the better of him. But they came, endued with divine, not with magic power, bearing a silver cross for their banner, and the image of our Lord and Saviour painted on a board, and chanting litanies, they offered up their prayers to the Lord for the eternal salvation both of themselves and of those to whom and for whom they had come. When they had sat down in obedience to the king's commands and preached to him and his attendants there present the word of life, the king answered thus, "Your words and promises are fair, but because they are new to us and of uncertain import, I cannot consent to them so far as to forsake that which I have so long observed with the whole English nation. But because you are come from far as strangers into my kingdom, and as I conceived are desirous to impart to us those things which you believe to be true and most beneficial, we desire not to harm you, but will give you favourable entertainment, and take care to supply you with all things necessary for your sustenance. Nor do we forbid you to preach and gain as many as you can to your religion." Accordingly, he gave them an abode in the city of Canterbury, which was the metropolis of all his dominions, and as he had promised, besides supplying them with sustenance, did not refuse them liberty to preach. It is told that, as they drew near to the city after their manner, with the Holy Cross and the image of our sovereign Lord and King Jesus Christ, they sang in concert this liturgy: "We beseech thee, Lord, for thy great mercy, that thy wrath and anger be turned away from this city, and that from thy holy house, for we have sinned. Alleluia." So as I said, there are other things going on here, aren't there? Okay? Augustine doesn't come into a land which is completely devoid of a Christian presence, because Ethelbert's got a Christian wife, Bertha. Why has Ethelbert got a Christian wife called Bertha? Yes, yeah, so what's the point? It's ties, isn't it? It's alliances. It is obviously there's some Frankish kings in the northern, what's today northern France, who think that ties with these Anglo-Saxons is quite a good idea, and therefore are prepared to marry their daughter to him, even though he's a pagan. He's obviously a sufficiently sympathetic pagan that they're happy to send her and her train and her sort of bishop lackey, or whatever, however you want to think about that, over to England in order to be able to preserve her religion. It's quite interesting, isn't it? There's obviously a web of links that have already been forged here by the time Augustine arrives, which means that Augustine is able to get a good hearing. There are Frankish interpreters who clearly are able to speak Anglo-Saxon and therefore are able to communicate this message. This is not as simple as someone being sent from Rome at the front of a procession, heading up this. Bede identifies that, doesn't he? He identifies that there's other stuff going on. They're received in Canterbury. This, of course, is why Canterbury is the archbishopric. Because that is where this is the historical time, so that's why Canterbury, at the end of the 20th century, celebrated 1400 years as a cathedral city, because this is when the archbishop came there. This is when, you know, this is ultimately the archbishop. So that's part of our history, isn't it? Because, frankly, Canterbury is a really silly place to put an archbishopric if you look at a map of the UK, isn't it? It's right in the bottom corner. Utterly inaccessible because it's the other side of London. So you only go there to catch a ferry. So I'm an equal opportunities offender. I've done the Welsh and the Cornish. I'm going to just go around the whole UK. I'm just during today. So that's obviously you can see there's other stuff going on there. There's some quite interesting stuff about how this starts with a willingness to permitting the Christians to come and preach the gospel there. Okay. Though they're not ready to convert yet. And obviously Bede's story is about how that happens. I love the bit about meeting outside in case they do any magic spells. It is interesting, you know, the tendency towards externality, which you see in, which is always a danger in religion, that you can perhaps detect in, we came endued with divine, not with magic power, bearing a silver cross for their banner and the image of our Lord and Saviour painted on a board. Almost as if those are the equivalent of magical artefacts, but they're not magical power, it's divine power. Do you notice that? That there's this sort of externalisation that somehow these objects, are they representative of divine power? Or do they actually have divine power in themselves? That's quite an interesting question that you detect. Do you remember our conversation about icons last week? Mm-hmm. This is the sort of, I think you can argue either way from this particular document, but given our awareness of how these things can be used, there is in this period an externality, that is a desire to put things into externals, which I think is always a tendency in any kind of religious observance, isn't it? It's always easier to mark it out by saying, well, we do this, 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 and this. These are our practices, and therefore that's what makes us Christians, rather than it being about a relationship with Jesus Christ, which you can't kind of, you know, you can't as easily take a photograph of or describe to people by saying, look, it's this. But anyway, there we are. That's Bede. I like Bede. And I think the other thing, as someone pointed out this morning, I doubt that Ethelbert quite said it in that delightful Latin that Bede records his history in. But then this is, Bede is trying to write history as the ancient wrote history. And therefore he's using this kind of elevated phraseology that rulers... And obviously he's very sympathetic to Ethelbert, isn't he? Sympathetic to Augustine. He writes a story which is about the coming together and the reconversion of what becomes England. Any questions so far?
Bede was later, so he's...
Yeah. Bede is writing in the 8th century. He writes the ecclesiastical history in 731. Right. So he's presumably writing from sources. He's a pretty good historian. He's quite careful. So if you notice in that paragraph, at the end he says, it is told that as they drew near to the city. There's a historical caution there. I have heard it said that they sung these words. I'm not prepared to say to you they definitely did it, but I have been told that they did. So there is a historian's cautiousness in there. You know, actually, a source written 150 years later reflecting on early documents is a pretty good source most of the time, if you've got early documents in case. I mean, you know, beggars can't be choosers, to be perfectly honest. We haven't got anything better. But Bede is alive from the end of the 7th century. So we're only talking about events that happened 100 years before Bede's lifetime. So this is a bit like me, you know, this is a bit like me writing about stuff that happened in the 1870s. I'm not completely divorced from it, but obviously you've got to go back for some records. But you are at the boundaries of information that's been passed down. So that's, you know, he's a decent historian, not perfect, but he's not bad. So he's talking about this story. The other story that's going on here is the mission from Ireland. Ireland becomes Christian, with all the caveats about what that means, in the 5th century, as a result, and into the 6th century, as a result of St. Patrick. Now, St. Patrick is a slightly disputed historical figure. Exactly where his dates are slightly disputed, so let's just say 5th century for him. But clearly, by this period, by 600 AD, Ireland has a well-established Christian setup with bishops and dioceses and so on and so forth. Has a very strong monastic Christianity, learned from the Desert Fathers of North Africa. It's a very strong monastic tradition within Irish Christianity. That's not monasteries in the way that we think of them, necessarily, as places of purely as places of retreat and silence and silent study. The monasteries we're dealing with are slightly different. The Benedictine rule, which is the one that we're more familiar with, doesn't come until a little bit later. So these are not necessarily the kind of austere places that we would assume them to be. But you do get this monasticism spreading across from Ireland, bringing with it Celtic Christianity. Now, talking about this morning, I want to be a little cautious with the term Celtic Christianity, because it has been so massively misused in the 20th century to mean pretty much anything to anyone, that I'm not sure that it's a helpful term. It perhaps might be better to talk about Irish Christianity at this period. But what you certainly do get is another mission coming across from Ireland and comes across to the north, because the obvious place, look at your map one, the obvious place to come across from Ireland is to Strathclyde. So monasteries spread, and of course if Strathclyde is still a British kingdom, then you can receive a welcome there, because it will be at least formally Christian probably. And monasteries spread across from that area. So key monasteries here will be Iona, Lindisfarne, Jarrow, places like that. And it is that sort of Celtic stream that comes across from Ireland and comes down through Northumbria. Essentially, to cut a long story short, at some time in the 7th century, these two streams meet somewhere in the middle. Okay? The presenting issue of their potential conflict is the date of Easter. Okay? Now, the date of Easter is always a tricky thing, because you date Easter based on the date of the Passover. But the question arises as to whether you can celebrate Easter on the Sunday that is the same, that is the day of the Passover, Nisan 14, or whether you have to celebrate it afterwards. So you've instantly got this dispute: is whether you celebrate Easter between on Nisan the 14th to the 20th, Jewish months, or the 15th to the 21st. That creates one issue. But also at this period in history, you don't have the settled calendar that we deal with, the Gregorian calendar. You have got a calendar which is a bit of a mess, and that means that every so often you have to find extra months in order to make it work. And your way of doing that is not agreed, okay? So whether you've got a 19-year cycle or an 84-year cycle or a set of 19-year cycles basically means you've got a little bit of complexity over precisely when these days fall. To cut a long story short, and please do go away and research this if you want, but I wouldn't commend it to you, you have to sort out when Easter is and agree when it's going to be. And at the Synod of Whitby in 664 AD, amongst other things, the Northumbrians agreed to a Roman Easter. The significance of that is twofold. One, it means that you've got an agreed Easter across the whole of England, that they're all celebrating Easter at the same time. Of course, Easter is the principal festival of Christianity. The other thing, of course, is at this point, Northumbria, for much of the 7th century, is the most powerful of the kingdoms. It is generally Edwin or his sons who are the Bretwalds, the most powerful kings. And therefore, the Synod of Whitby, that's in Northumbria. They are, in a sense, saying, right, this is what we're deciding to do. It's the same pattern we've seen earlier, isn't it, with emperors calling a synod saying, right, this is what we're deciding to do. Here it happens to be an English king, and it's a local synod, but you still see that same marrying up of ecclesiastical and civil power, how one feeds off the others. So there we are. So next time you go to Whitby, remember it's not just a beautiful seaside place. It is also home to the synod that decided when Easter was going to be. So if your school holidays are a mess, it's their fault. Good. Again, much of our information from this period does come from Bede, so let's have a look at him. The Venerable Bede I've given you the dates for his ecclesiastical history of the English people. You can, I think you can, you used to be able to, pick this up as a Penguin classic. It's a nice book. It's a good, the Penguin classic I think is a slightly more modernised text than the one I'm using. It's off the internet. So that is a good read if you want to read something from this period. What about Bede? Well, didn't we give you Bede as an example of a 7th century English churchman? So he's born in 673 AD. From the age of 7, he's identified as a bright boy and therefore is educated at Wearmouth Abbey. And then he goes from Wearmouth to Jarrow. He is deaconed aged 19, becomes a priest as soon as he can, therefore at age 30. He studies the Latin Bible. His main work is a Bible commentator, but he also wrote his ecclesiastical history. Jarrow and Wearmouth, monasteries at this time, are big cultural centres. There's around about 600 monks, as far as we can work out from various records. They've got these are stone buildings. So when most of the architecture is either a base of stone and wood, or just purely being made from wood, a stone building means that you're putting a priority into it. There's evidence of stained glass. So these are the kind of very important. These are the effectively the cathedrals of their day in terms of the architectural effort put into them. So Jarrow and Wearmouth, big, important monasteries, cultural centres, not just centres of retreat for monks, cultural centres in their areas. Another interesting fact about Bede is he was the one who popularised the AD format as a historian. So we have him to thank for that. He dies in 735. I've got that. You got that on the sheet. And he writes his History of the English People, which is basically the story the story of the progress from diversity to unity. So his big story is how you end up with Christianity coming from here and coming from there, but you end up with a united Christendom. And obviously the Synod of Whitby is a big factor in that. So that's the story he's telling. You know, how did England become Christian again? How did England become united in faith? Not a united country, because that doesn't follow for a few centuries, but that's his story. And I've got a bit more Bede here. I'm not going to read chapter 12 out because it's long. You can have a look at that. Basically, to summarise, in chapter 12 we're dealing with King Edwin. King Edwin is going to be, he isn't quite at this stage, is going to be the King of Northumbria and a very important King of Northumbria. And basically what happens is Edwin sees a vision or meets a kind of angelic figure who promises him that if he follows Christ, then he'll be successful, pretty much. And then Paulinus, who's one of the folk trying to evangelise the Northumbrians at this period, sort of follows that story up, and Edwin allows him to come and talk to him about faith. And then what you happen, and this is where we're going to pick it up in chapter 13, the king decides to gather all his counsellors together and to talk about what they should do about it. So, this is bottom of page 4, book 2, chapter 13. The king, hearing these words, answered that he was both willing and bound to receive the faith which Paulinus taught, but that he would confer about it with his chief friends and counsellors, to the end that if they were also of his opinion, they might altogether be consecrated to Christ in the font of life. Paulinus consenting, the king did as he said, for holding a council with the wise men, he asked of every one in particular what they thought of this doctrine hitherto unknown to them, and the new worship of God that was preached. The chief of his own priests, Cophi, immediately answered him, O king, consider what this which is now preached to us. For I verily declare to you that I have learned beyond doubt that the religion which we have hitherto professed has no virtue in it and no profit. For none of your people has applied himself more diligently to the worship of the gods than I, and yet there are many who receive greater favours from you, and are more preferred than I, and are more prosperous in all that they undertake to do or to get. Now, if the gods were good for anything, they would rather forward me, who have been careful to serve them with greater zeal. It remains, therefore, that if upon examination you find these new doctrines which are now preached to us better and more efficacious, we hasten to receive them without any delay. It's interesting, isn't it? Because Bede's happy to record Kofi's view of things. It's an interesting idea of how of why you might embrace Christianity. Do you know, like Kofi's argument? I've been priest and I've worked really hard, but it's not done me any good, so maybe I'll try this other religion. Okay, well, you might have some slight cautions about that argument. All right, well, that's not the only one that's recorded. Another of the king's chief men, approving of his wise words and exhortations, added thereafter, "The present life of man upon earth, O king, seems to me, in comparison with that time which is unknown to us, like to the swift flight of a sparrow through the house wherein you sit at supper in night in winter with your earl men and thanes, while the fire blazes in the midst and the hall is warmed, but the wintry storms of rain or snow are raging abroad. The sparrow, flying in at one door and immediately out of another, whilst he is within, is safe from the wintry tempest. But after a short space of fair weather, he immediately vanishes out of your sights, passing from winter into winter again. So this life of man appears for a little while, but of what is to follow, or what went before, we know nothing at all. If, therefore, this new doctrine tells us something more certain, it seems justly to deserve to be followed." The other elders and king's counsellors, by divine prompting, spoke to the same effect. So it's interesting. Kofi's response is recorded, but the one that is persuasive in the argument is this one. Have you come across this this thing before, the sparrow thing? I think it's one of Bede's. I'm not aware that it comes from anyone else but Bede. I need to check that, but I'm pretty sure this is Bede's. I love the imagery, though. So the image, you've got to imagine that you're sitting in a long hall at this point. One of those old, we possibly associate them more with Vikings and with Saxons, but these long, long halls, wooden hall, okay? You're sitting gathered around the fire because it's freezing outside. You're in Northumbria, okay? So it's, you know, it's cold and it's winter. It's raining, stroke snowing, stroke raining the whole time. You've got a burning fire in the minute. And obviously, because you've not got any sophisticated windows, you've just got holes. Through one of the holes, a sparrow flies in from outside, flies through the room, flies through the hall, and flies out the other side. And basically, the line goes, the king's chief man says, "Look, we don't know what's going on out there, and we don't know what's going out there. We've just, all we know about is this little bit here, and then you pass from winter to winter, and yet this new religion seems to be able to tell us a little bit more about what happened there, and a little bit about what's going to happen there, and therefore that might be a better idea." I like it as an argument, I must admit. I think there's a certain poetic beauty to it. It's one of my favourite passages in Bede. I particularly like the sparrow flying in at one door and immediately out of another, whilst he is within is safe from the wintry tempest, but after a short space of fair weather, he immediately vanishes out of your sight, passing from winter into winter again. And always important, isn't it, that you can tell this is an English illustration because it's mainly about the weather. So, it is truly in the vernacular. The understanding of rain and snow is integral to it. So that's quite interesting. And that seems to be the argument that clinches it. The fact that this new religion, this faith, it offers certainty. The uncertainty that goes with the pagan gods, the unknownness of whether or not you've appeased them, whether you've done the right thing, whether you've tried to appease the right God. The same issue that you find in Corinth, where the Corinthians, not Corinth, Athens, where the Athenians had an altar to an unknown God. It's the same issue, isn't it? There might be somebody we've missed. And if these gods are anything like the Greco-Roman gods, then they're basically squabbling children. And therefore, you might have appeased one God, but in appeasing one God, you've offended another. And therefore, you have no certainty for life. And so here comes this faith, which offers certainty. Now, I know this is a bit of poetry, but I do think it does encapsulate some of the reason why Christianity was able to spread, as far as we can work out, so rapidly, when the alternative religion is such a religion of despair. Because it offers you, basically, uncertainty for this life. And that's the best it's got. Whereas Christianity offers you certainty not just about this life, but also about what the future holds and what the past is all about. It's an interpretation of history, isn't it? So I think you can see, for all the poetry, that there is something being said here about that the way in which Christianity offers a more complete solution to man's needs than any of these pagan gods of the Anglo-Saxons. Then we go back to Kofi. But Kofi added that he wished more attentively to hear Paulinus discourse concerning the God whom he preached. When he did so, at the king's command, Kofi, hearing these words, cried out, "This long time I have perceived that what we worship was naught, because the more diligently I sought after truth in that worship, the less I found it. But now I freely confess that such truth evidently appears in this preaching as confer on us the gifts of life, of salvation, and of eternal happiness. For which reason my counsel is, O king, that we instantly give up to ban and fire those temples and altars which we have consecrated without reaping any benefit from them." In brief, the king openly assented to the preaching of the gospel by Paulinus, and renouncing idolatry declared that he received the faith of Christ. And when he inquired of the aforesaid high priest of his religion, who should first desecrate the altars and temples of their idols with the precincts that were about them, he answered, "I, for whom can more fittingly than myself destroy those things which I worshipped in my folly, as an example to all others, through the wisdom which has been given me by the true God?" Then immediately, in contempt of his vain superstitions, he desired the king to furnish him with arms and a stallion, that he might mount and go forth to destroy the idols, for it was not lawful before for the high priest either to carry arms or to ride anything but a mare. Having therefore girt a sword about him with a spear in his hand, he mounted the king's stallion and went his way to the idols. The multitude, beholding it, thought that he was mad. But as soon as he drew near the temple, he did not delay to desecrate it by casting into it the spear which he held. And rejoicing in the knowledge of the worship of the true God, he commanded his companions to tear down and set on fire the temple with all its precinct. This place where the idols once stood is still shown, not far from York, to the eastward, beyond the river Derwent, and is now called Godmundingle, where the high priest, by the inspiration of the true God, profaned and destroyed the altars which he had himself consecrated. It was very, very similar, wasn't it? Yes. Yes, it is interesting. So it does cause you pause. So negatively you think, "Oh, hang on, is this not a bit..." Then you have to say, but the proof is in the pudding. So the other thing that Kofi does is not pragmatic at all. Because a pragmatic route would be to leave those temples and idols alone, just in case. He's actually quite happy to destroy and desecrate them and to lead the march against them. So, you know, just as with Constantine, you have this sort of reservation about how it comes, but afterwards Constantine has Bibles translated, you know, builds churches, you think, well, okay, as far as we can, you know, the proof is in the pudding, that looks like a genuine conversion, because it's not all about sort of political realities. You actually do some stuff which might put you out there and might make you unpopular with certain elements. You know, that wasn't the easiest thing for Kofi to do. So I think it is, but I agree with you, I think there's very great similarities in the way it looks and the way it works. What would you say about it? Positively, you'd say many people have mixed motives in coming to Christ, and yet the Lord is sovereign. Negatively, you might worry about a peddling of Christianity that suggested it was the way to get better harvests. And, you know, I mean, it's true in a global sense, isn't it, that Christianity is the better way. It's much more difficult when you try and break that down to the better way for me, so that I will be more prosperous last year than I am this. That's not quite the same thing. And you do have that issue. I think part of it is you've got quite a lot of the sort of Old Testament in here, because you're dealing with kings. There's quite a lot about, you know, the prosperity that seems to be linked to, say, Abraham's faithfulness, or Isaac's faithfulness, or David's faithfulness, or Solomon's faithfulness. That when they were faithful, they were materially blessed. So that seems to be influencing things here a bit.
And, I mean, I wonder if it's just the way that the Holy Spirit actually managed to reach these two guys. You know,
yeah, I think
by making them look at, you know,
at the
what they were getting from their
yeah.
own cross.
Yeah, no, I think that's perfectly possible. It's just interesting as you read it. I think it's good, isn't it, as we look at the sources to just reflect on them and think, well, what's going on here? And that's what I like about Bede, because he records it, and he records, interestingly, without masses of comment, what people are saying. So that allows you to sort of reflect on it a bit, doesn't it? You know, this is how the argument went. You know, rather than just saying, oh, well, everybody had a really nice time and was really happy and they came to Christ, end of story. There's a bit more detail in that, and the detail allows us to reflect and to think about what's going on here. To recognise both the dissimilarities of people, you know, and how they were thinking about the life 1400 years ago, and also the similarities, the same basic issues that are ours today. You know, what is life all about? What I do like about Kofi's response is the link between faith and repentance and change. So I'm struck, you know, it reminded me a bit of the 1 Thessalonians stuff. You've turned away from idols to the living God. There's a very visible, active turning away from idols here, isn't there? That presumably we take positively. I just, you know, I mean, it is what it is. It's a source just for us to reflect on and think, what is this telling us? Any other comments on that? Yeah, bit of historical. This is the story of how Christianity came to England. Shall I carry on? So that's there. That is the reconversion of England. So we're around about 800 AD now. If you go back to map 2, you can see Anglo-Saxon England in about AD 800. Two reasons for that map. One is because it shows Mercia at its most powerful. And we are all, of course, here good Mercians, aren't we? You can see Lichfield and Tamworth on our map. Are you a Northumbrian? Are you north of the Humber?
No.
No, I don't think you are. It's all right, we'll let you stay. Most of us are good Mercians. You're on the border, yeah, well, it depends. The border's probably not exact at this point. And most of that round the River Humber's marsh anyway. So you can see the office kingdom. And this is kind of Anglo-Saxon England just before the Vikings turn up. And it all becomes a bit of a mess again. So that's those are the kingdoms. The Heptarchy at its most obvious, where Offa is in charge, where Offa's dike has been built. Now, interestingly, just as a little aside, Offa's dike is a massive earthwork that goes all the way along the Welsh border, not the actual Welsh border, our Welsh border. Okay, you have got to be able to shift some serious manpower in order to get that built. There is no good reason to doubt that Offa had it built. It's logical for him to have it built. He's the one who pushes Mercia's border across as far as it does, and then basically said, right, well, we better, this is where the border is. But he's managing to move huge amounts of manpower in order to get that built, which shows you a little bit about the power of these English kings, that they were able to have, they had sufficient authority. We don't quite know how. They had sufficient authority to be able to get hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands of men and man hours in order to build a massive earthwork. Because you've got no diggers, you've just got dodgy shovels. It's not like you've even got modern spades, is it? You know, you've got spades, but not good ones. So that's that. And then we get to the Vikings. So the Vikings first turn up in the written record. Again, the Vikings are a people about whom others write, not who write about themselves at this period. So the Vikings first turn up in the written record, as far as England is concerned, in 793, when they attack, raid the monastery at Lindisfarne. Okay. As a result of which, Lindisfarne is actually abandoned in 875 AD. So there are lots of attacks on the northeast coast, Lindisfarne, that kind of area, which obviously is quite disruptive for the this, you know, this is where these cultural centres start to disappear, because they're too easily attacked from the sea, because of course that's the direction that the Vikings are coming from mostly. Certainly from an English perspective, they're obviously going to Dublin as well. Initially, the Vikings are raiders at the end of the 8th century and into the 9th century. But in 865 AD, a large force invades and captures York. And during this period, in the late 9th century, they took over most of Mercia, East Anglia, and Northumbria, but not Wessex. And you can, if you look over at map 3, you can see by the end of the 9th century, you get this division between English territory, Northumberland, Mercia, the bit of Mercia and Wessex, and Danish or Norse territory. And then you can still see Celtic lands. And notice, one of the reasons I picked this map for you is because it shows you that at this period, the country doesn't quite look like it does today, because you've got lots of swamp. So notice how East Anglia would be quite a lot more separate from Anglia, from Mercia, than it is today, because of these large swamp areas. You know, so the River Humber, there's a lot of swamp or alluvium. What's alluvium? Go on. Deposited river debris, thank you very much. So basically, you've got a situation where you've got a result of periodic flooding, usually, isn't it? Alluvium? Result of periodic flooding? And therefore, you've got an unstable coastline, and this is not land that you can simply farm on. So you can see that York is, you can see it's just, I just give you that map just to show you partly that things, the coastline looks different than it does did today. It's not just Holland, where you've got a large reclamation of land. It's also something that historically has happened in England too. So you've got the Danelaw, and I'm sorry, I was most disappointed to learn that that having lived always in English territory, I've now moved here to what was the Danelaw, which explains many things. And I was told this morning that Derby, with its Viking name, was one of the five capitals of the Danelaw. So there we are, a brief moment in the sun for Derby during the late 9th century.
last moment of the sun.
But you can see that you've then got this split. Okay, that brings us to Alfred. What's King Alfred famous for? Burning the cakes. Yes, and also he's the one who's attributed to whom is attributed the founding of the English Navy. Okay, whether either story is true, who knows. But Alfred is king of Wessex, 875 to 899. So at this period, Wessex stretches all the way across and has started to include Kent and East and Sussex and these other areas, and gradually starts to take on Mercia as well. And Alfred is the first of the kings of Wessex who you can begin to trace a direct line to the modern British monarchy, in the sense that he's the first English king who can claim to be the king of the English. Now, at this point, it's not the whole of England, but it's him and his sons and successors who gradually, through the 10th century, are able to reclaim much of the Danelaw. Although there's still Vikings there, there's still Viking settlement, but that area comes under the rule gradually during the 10th century of English kings. So what do we make of Alfred? Alfred's quite an interesting figure. We know quite a bit about him. We know that he was keen on the education in English. That's not English as we know English, but English as a language that begins to look a little bit like ours, to have some affinities. We know that he tried to restore monasteries, although that was a struggle because he had to bring in monks from overseas. Such had been the effect of the Viking raids on monasteries during the 9th century. There are various other things about him that we see his activity. Because you get the Dane law and English Mercia and Wessex, and because even within the Dane law you've got you've still got English people living, because the Viking settlement never seems to be on the scale, the same scale as the Anglo-Saxon settlement, you don't have the same issue with the loss of Christianity. You see some Viking burials, but it's not quite such a sweeping away of Christianity as you saw in the 5th and 6th centuries. So during this period of expansion, you gradually get the re-Christianization of that area. The Vikings gradually become Christians, and that seems to be something that happens comparatively straightforwardly. Again, I think you might go back to that illustration of the sparrow through the long haul. You know, if you've got, I think the comparison today would be animism. You know, the uncertainty of animism, where you've got ancestors that you're trying to appease. That actually, that's a system that people are often very happy to come out of, because it offers no hope. Anyway, that's what you get during the 10th and 11th centuries. A unified England emerges from Wessex northwards. So by the 11th century, you've actually got kings of England. Okay. One of the first of them is Ethelred the Unready. Then you get King Canute, 1016 to 1042. Who's Danish? Yes, who's a Viking, but has a claim to the throne. So by this point, all the relationships are intermingled. There's intermarriage, and therefore he may well be Danish, but he's unquestionably the English king. You then have that period, and by 1066, there's two battles in 1066. The second of which is the Battle of Hastings, which Harold loses to William. Okay, William of, and Normandy is called Normandy because they're Norman, Norsemen, Vikings. Normandy was an area that was ceded to the North. That's how the Franks settled it. They gave Normandy to the Normans, to the Norsemen in the 10th century. Okay, so that's the second battle. The first battle is the Battle of. Yes, and at that, Harold defeats the Vikings. Yeah. So it's very interesting. He, in the space of 2 weeks, he defeats the Vikings in the north, and that's the last time Vikings ever try to attack the north of England, which sounds so obvious now, because, of course, 1066 and all that, we know that the Vikings, that's it for the Vikings, but actually, there's no reason at the time to expect that you aren't going to get more Vikings like Harald Hardrada and others trying to push their claims to the English crown, and then goes south and loses to the French. So it's not our best year, is it? So 1066, the last time we lost to French, though, so that's good. I think I've still got some of the nations in Europe to offend. So do let me know at a coffee who I haven't yet offended, and I'll make sure that we complete the set by the end of the night. And so that's really new. That is the end of Anglo-Saxon England in terms of the way our history books tell the tale. And it is quite a big breach, because, as we'll see after the break, you get quite a big change in how government works. You get a much more centralised government, and we really enter the medieval period. But we enter the medieval period with England as a Christian country, okay? And we'll see the impact of that after the break. Does anybody want to ask any questions at this point? Anything that we've missed in our potted history of England, Christian and otherwise, from 400 to 1066? That wasn't bad.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, I haven't traced this. It's clear. It will be during the period when Mercia was significant. The thing that slightly hexes me on this is that Lichfield, which isn't that far away, that's the historic bishopric. So Repton must have been the seat of, or one of the seats of, the Mercian king. Now, I'd have to check this, but kings in this period often didn't have one particular place that they ruled from in the way that the parallel is the queen, because if you think about the queen, you can still see within the queen that the queen has palace in London, palace in Windsor, a house in, is there one in Cambridge somewhere?
Norfolk.
Same thing, just to make sure, a bit more offending. Sandringham, Norfolk, Suffolk, all the same thing. There we go. That's just for the tape. And obviously the place in Scotland.
And the Isle of Wight.
And the Isle of Wight. Now that actually, that starts to give you the old idea of a monastic progress, where kings would move from house to house, which is two things. One, because kings tended to come with a big retinue, and therefore you didn't want to have to feed them for too long. But it also means that that's how you keep on top of your domains, isn't it? You keep moving round. You go and stay with someone, you stay in this place for a while. So the idea of a fixed capital is a later idea, because at this point, the administration would largely travel with the king. Therefore, if the king is in Oxford, that's where the capital is, because that's where the Chancellor of the Exchequer is. That's where it's only later that you start having London as a set, as sort of an administrative centre wherever the king is. So that's probably. But I'd have to look at, because I've seen the sign, historic capital of Mercia, and I must chase that up. But that's probably part of it, that you, to talk of a capital in the way that we talk of capitals is a slight misnomer.
I think in Mercian times, the history of Mercia, the capital moves.
Yeah, it will do as well. Yeah. Good. Any other questions? Yes.
The two main cathedrals are Canterbury and York.
Yeah.
So we know how Canterbury.
Yes.
I
think York is as a result of the. I'd have to check this, but I'm pretty sure it's a result of the fact that Northumbria was, during the 7th century, a key, and also it then became the Viking capital. So those two things together, you know, it's the big city. I mean, it's really interesting, isn't it? If you look at that map, map 3, and look at the places that are marked out as the important places, okay? So York's there. Durham, okay, that makes sense. Cambridge, London, Canterbury, but then you've got Chippenham, Eddington, Wareham, Wantage. Now, those are important sites in the 9th century. With respect, not today. Sorry. So, you know, that's the reality, that some of these cities maintain their significance. You know, Lichfield Diocese used to be massive. Absolutely massive. Lichfield, York and Lincoln between them pretty much carved up. Most we'd have been Lichfield. Yeah. Lincoln, yeah, it's in the swamp, which is why later on it's such good farmland. Because if you recover it from alluvial deposits, it's good land. It's why Lincolnshire still is a kind of breadbasket type place. It's also why it's flat as anything. Well, the highest things are the motorway bridges. Another county ticked off. So you can see, you know, it's interesting, isn't it? The continuity and change is interesting. It's also why you've got a historically a massive weighting of bishoprics in the south of England. It's sort of historical reasons. And it's also why county sizes are fairly standard until you get to sort of Chester, Derbyshire, really. You know, Lincolnshire historically is quite large, but Yorkshire was massive. Lancashire was massive. But what seems to have happened is that the administration, the county boundaries that was going on that you can trace to this period, you know, once you get north of the Mersey and north of the Humber, everyone just sort of shrugs their shoulders and go, I don't know. Them and them, just how many counties do we need? Two, three? And the boundaries don't seem fixed, which is interesting because that's continued to cause issues in future, isn't it? Because Yorkshire keeps getting carved up because it's sort of too big. Lancashire used to include Manchester, Liverpool. You know, it was a huge county, but you end up creating a new number of counties out of it. That's not just because of the Industrial Revolution, it's all to do with the size of the county. Of course, Durham was set because Durham was a county palatine, which means that Durham was ruled by the bishop, which is why the bishop has a palace on the scale that the Bishop of Durham has. because he was not just the bishop, he was also the ruler. So the palace is also a castle, effectively.
So what does the church look like at the end of it, before the Normans arrived? I mean, a lot of churches were built by the Normans.
Well, a lot of churches were knocked down by the Normans and rebuilt. They're a bit like the Victorians in that. So they were quite happy to trash what had gone before. So so for example, let's take this church. There is good evidence that there was a church on this site from the 9th century, 8th, 9th century onwards. Okay, and then the Normans would have come along, probably knocked the old one down and built a new one.
So what was the structure like in the church?
We'll come on to the Normans, but the Anglo-Saxon ones, it's really difficult to tell because so many of them were knocked down. What we can tell is that they tend to be simpler than later Norman churches, if they were built in stone. You know, low, not quite such sort of high walls and various vaults and so forth. But the usual cruciform shape, that seems to be fairly standard, but generally a bit smaller. But it's difficult to... the diocese in the south certainly is similar to what we have today. So a lot of the dioceses are pre-Norman in terms of their dates of founding. Particularly more established the further south you go on the whole. You know, if you look at this map, this map 3 again, you've got some historical cathedral cities there, haven't you? Exeter, Winchester, Canterbury, Rochester, London. You know, that these are established places. Chris, who was here this morning, was saying that he did a history of his church, which was in Devon, which they can trace to the 7th century. And for a long time, although it was in Devon, it was ruled from Salisbury, completely ignored the Bishop of Exeter, because the living belonged to the minster in Salisbury. And so it was the minster's responsibility and privilege to send a priest out to it. So the other thing that you get during this period, and which lasts well into the 20th century, is a lot of what later became known as peculiars. That if you got a map of the parishes that belonged to the, say, the Bishop of Lichfield, you would find obviously a concentration around, but you'd find little blobs of churches in odd places that actually owed their allegiance to the Bishop of Lichfield rather than the bishop that was nearer them, because it's who sent money here, who provided the money for the living, and who has authority to... It's a bit like the modern patronage system, you know, that churches have patrons. And there's a massive mixture of them. Some of them end up as Oxford colleges on Cambridge colleges, patrons of places. You get individuals who are patrons, you get organisations, but you still just get little oddities. Sometimes it's the crown, which is a real pain for them. There would have been...
Training for the
monastic training. So there would have been some who were trained in monasteries who would have had, and they would have been sent out from monasteries to serve in parishes sometimes. Training would have been very, very mixed. So in an urban area or near the monasteries, then you would have a level of education. You would have the capacity to read Latin. You'd have people who were who would have had at least heard the Bible read to them, or at least parts of it. Okay, there are Bibles in circulation. Latin again is the language here. Elsewhere you would have barely literate priests reciting what they could remember of the Latin Mass. It's a really mixed picture. Sorry? Just like today then. Yeah. That's a good time to go to coffee. Usually. Well, the Prime Minister is given a list with two names on it. One at the top and one underneath. And it is anticipated that the Prime Minister will choose the name on top. However, the Prime Minister doesn't always do that. Some Prime Ministers are famous for not doing that, because it is the Prime Minister's choice, except that you're choosing from a list which has been prepared for you. So it's quite interesting questions to who chooses bishops within the Church of England. And because the Queen is the supreme governor of the Church of England, it is ultimately, of course, Bishop Brooks are in her gift. Because there's no Pope, but the Church obviously is involved in presenting candidates. Anyway, this issue of who chooses bishops, who therefore is in charge of the Church, And obviously, the dispute develops, or the conversation is, how far is this something which the kings of England are in charge of, and how far is this something which the Pope, the Bishop of Rome, is in charge of. So that's one of the things that's really comes from this period. Other things happening, you get a new Benedictine monasticism. Saint Benedict is a more rigorous monastic rule that comes in from the 7th century. That kind of monasticism comes in with the Normans, and that's a different way of approaching monasticism. That's much more like the kind of our vision of monasteries as places of withdrawal from the world, and as places of sort of asceticism and denial of the body and all those kind of things, and silence, that kind of idea. You get new Norman bishops, you get new Norman churches, you get a real very deliberate suppression of English bishops, of Anglo-Saxon bishops, and replacement with Normans. This is one of the biggest periods for actual replacement of earls and bishops. That's what the Normans do. And obviously they're very closely related to the state. There is a close relationship between church and state. Senior clergy are king's advisors. You do, however, get some exceptions. So Lanfranc, who is Bishop of Canterbury up to 1093, he's really a scholar rather than a king's advisor. You then get Anselm, who we'll come on to shortly. This period also, late 11th century, is when Gregory VII is Pope, from 1073 to 1085. Now, Gregory VII, also known as Hildebrand, is one of the more successful medieval popes at getting kings and princes to recognise his authority. So there's a famous dispute he has, which we won't go into here, with one of the early Holy Roman Emperors about this. But this is the dispute. It's the dispute between whether it's the Pope who is ultimately in charge of appointing bishops, or whether actually these bishoprics are handed out in the same way that earldoms or lordships are handed out, as in they're the gift of the king to reward his faithful followers. And really, in England, for most of the medieval period, it's probably the latter rather than the former, really. It's whether church appointments are controlled by lay rulers or not. Then the other thing that you've got in this period is the First Crusade. First Crusade is 1095 AD. The Crusades are neither as simple as they were portrayed in the medieval period, i.e., the liberation of the Holy Land from the Moors, or whatever term you wanted to use, nor are they as simple as they are portrayed in the 21st century. That is, random acts of aggression by so-called Christians against Muslims. The truth is somewhere in between both those extremes. The First Crusade certainly was an attempt to allow pilgrims access to holy sites which they had previously been allowed to access, but were now being denied. As the Crusades goes, it was the most successful in that it resulted in the formation of the Crusader states, and for a period in the late 11th and 12th century, there were successful European states in that area, Christian states in the midst of a predominantly Muslim area. But the interesting thing about the First Crusade for our purpose is really that here you have something which is called by the Pope, Urban II, a call which is heard and obeyed, choose your terminology, by many, not kings in this instance, that comes later, but many lords within Europe who march off to do the Pope's bidding, to be a united Christendom against the enemy. So there's this mixture of Christendom, this idea of a pan-European Christendom. Europe's a lot smaller than it was later, but also the church being something which the monarchy, the king, runs in terms of bishoprics, in terms of the actual power. So you've got this quite mixed economy going on in the medieval church. Remember we said, didn't we, once we got to Constantine, you end up with Christendom. There are pros and cons to Christendom. here we see, I think, in the medieval period, some of the cons that, you know, where is the church as the prophetic voice into a culture when you can't distinguish between the two at all? So it's a Christian culture, but it's a certain kind of Christian culture. It's a quite militaristic Christian culture at times. See that sort of the tensions that there are with that. So that's what you get really through the medieval period from William I onwards. Then we come to Anselm of Canterbury. Anselm of Canterbury is Archbishop of Canterbury, funnily enough, 1093 to 1109. Anselm is actually born in 1033 in Italy. Now, of course, Italy until 1870 is a geographical designation rather than a country. But it is born in Italy. He is a monk, then he's a friar, then he's an abbot, and then he becomes Archbishop of Canterbury. So, you know, his route is scholarly rather than political, if you like. He has conflicts with William II, William the Conqueror's son, and Henry I over investiture, over what he's going to say when they're crowned, about who's bowing to whom and who's doing what to whom, because it's all about this question of the relationship between church and state. How independent is the church? Is the Archbishop of Canterbury basically just a lackey of the king, or is the Archbishop of Canterbury the spiritual leader of the English and of the English people? So he ends up spending quite a bit of time in exile. He remains Archbishop of Canterbury, but he's not active in his see. And then he writes, he's a scholar, so he writes this work called Cur Deus Homo, which is basically answering the question, is God, why does God need to become man? And here we get into one of the big features of medieval theology, which is the use of reason to demonstrate or prove the truth of faith. And Anselm does that. So this is the work, Cur Deo Homo. It's a work which discusses the incarnation and the atonement. Okay, it presents it as a dialogue with Boso. That's a sort of kind of literature that we've seen before. And it's an important historical work on the atonement. It's an important theological work because it asks this question, why does God need to become man? We'll look at some extracts in a minute, but here's basically how Anselm's reasoning goes. Okay. Why can't God just save people? Why can't God just say, you're saved? To which the answer would be, why couldn't God just do that?
Because he's holy.
And therefore the problem is, yeah, so the problem is sin, isn't it? Okay, so the problem, there's a problem of sin. God can't just let people off, can he? That would violate the moral order of the universe. Okay, if people are doing wrong things and they're just getting away with it, that's just wrong. Okay, so why not just punish them? Well, because that would violate God's intention in creating the world. This is the argument that Anselm pursues. So you can't let people off because that would violate natural justice and the moral order of the universe. You can't just punish people because actually God doesn't want to do that. That would violate his intention in creating the world. So how do you save people? Okay. Well, you need more than a man, he argues, because mankind, all men, are debtors to God. Debtors to God because of sin, but debtors to God basically by being created. You need, therefore, God in order to save. However, God shouldn't be paying because he's God, doesn't owe anything. Man should pay, but can't. God can pay, but shouldn't. And therefore, the way to save is to have someone who is God and man. Now, very interesting. Quite a neat little argument, actually. But if you had a but, what might the but be? A terrible sentence. What might you, if you read that argument, what might you say to it?
Less than problem.
There's a question, there's that question. There's also the question of why are these the reasons that you adduce? So why does God letting people off violate the moral order of the universe? Where does that moral order come from? Why does not punishing violate God's intention in creating the world? How do we know that that's God's intention? So although this is an argument from reason, and it is, it's quite effective, there are some fundamental assumptions about the universe, that how the universe works, that are not reasoned out. Now that's true of any argument from reason that anyone ever makes. Those who are more honest will acknowledge their presuppositions. But any reasoned argument always comes with presuppositions. Okay? So, to give an example, if you could do any kind of reasoning about why an apple falls to the ground, then and you're going to put an experiment together which you're going to repeat, you're making an assumption about the fact that the forces of gravity is basically a constant. Now, you might say that's a very reasonable assumption, okay? But it is an assumption. We are assuming that gravity will basically stay the same. There's no way we can prove that it will, because we can't be certain about the future. We can't be certain about the past. We can assume, because we have observed that gravity is like this, but we could make an assumption. Do you see what I mean? There are always baseline assumptions that are not unreasoned, but that are ultimately beyond searching out. So always be aware with an argument from reason, and this is one of them, that there are some things that are not reasoned. There are assumptions that are made that lie behind the reasons that you make. Does that make sense? So Anselm's assumption is that God can't just let people off because that would violate the moral order of the universe. I think he's probably right, but it's an assumption. You know what I mean? It's an assumption about how the universe works. But anyway, let's have a little look at a couple of chapters of this. I'm going to read the first one. I'm not going to read the second one because I'm not going to read book 2, chapter 1, and then we'll do book 2, chapter 22. But let's have a look at his methodology. I have been often and most earnestly requested by many, both personally and by letter, that I would hand down in writing the proofs of a certain doctrine of our faith, which I am accustomed to give to inquirers. For they say that these proofs gratify them and are considered sufficient. This they ask, not for the sake of attaining to faith by means of reason, but that they may be gladdened by understanding and meditating on those things which they believe, and that as far as possible they may be always ready to convince anyone who demands of them a reason of that hope which is in us. And this question, both infidels are accustomed to bring against us, ridiculing Christian simplicity is absurd, and many believers ponder it in their hearts. For what cause or necessity, in sooth, God became man, and by his own death, as we believe and affirm, restored life to the world. When he might have done this, by means of some other being, angelic or human, or merely by his will. Not only the learned, but also many unlearned persons interest themselves in this inquiry and seek for its solution. Therefore, since many desire to consider this subject, and though it seemed very difficult in the investigation, it is yet plain to all in the solution, and attractive for the value and beauty of the reasoning. Although what ought to be sufficient has been said by the Holy Fathers and their successors, yet I will take pains to disclose to inquirers what God has seen fit to lay open to me. And since investigations, which are carried out by question and answer, are thus made more plain to many, and especially to less quick minds, and on that account are more gratifying, I will take to argue with me one of those persons who agitate this subject, one who among the rest compels me more earnestly to it, so that in this way Boso may question and Anselm reply. So notice there's going to be a dispute. Boso's going to ask questions, Anselm's going to answer. Anselm is giving an answer which he's given before, and he's saying, look, people have found this profitable, so I'm happy to share it with you. He's cautious about it. He says, look, you know, we shouldn't really need it because we've got what the Holy Fathers have given us, but, you know, people have found it useful, so I'll give it to you. Notice his reasoning. He says, look, this is so that people who have faith may have a reason for the hope they have. It is also so that those who are asking questions would be able to have a reasoned response as to why it is that God becomes man. So far, so good. The interesting thing, though, is that when Anselm talks about reason, he is talking about a particular kind of reason. He is talking about logic, a logical argument based on largely Aristotelian logic, where you work through an argument in a certain way. So when he says reason, this is what he's talking about. Now, there's nothing wrong in that. There's a lot of merit in Aristotelian logic. there's a lot of merit in being able to sort of take apart people's arguments and show just how rubbish they are. Okay, it's probably something we should do better than we do. But it is interesting that what he then feels he needs to do is to refer to Scripture as little as possible, so that the argument he's making is an argument that is just about reason, that it's a logical argument that he's making. And that obviously takes him in a certain direction in terms of how his argument proceeds. Book 2, chapter 1, I will not read because it gets quite hard to follow in the middle. It's basically saying, look, man's purpose is to be happy and to enjoy God, to be holy and happy and to enjoy God. And he talks there about the importance of us being rational and being able to discern truth and falsehood and good and evil and greater and lesser good. Okay. An issue with Anselm's argument here is the question of the impact of sin. That is, does Anselm give sufficient weight to the way in which sin doesn't just something that affects what we do, it also affects how we think? That is, as sinners, we don't always think rightly, we don't always do rightly. Do we have the rational capacity that we were created with in order to be able to argue things out in the way that Anselm suggests we can? Well, that's a question. Does he take account of the fall sufficiently and its impact on our reasoning? That is, can you risk putting the Bible to one side in order to make your argument? Or is that too risky a proposition? Because by doing so, you very easily untether yourself and head off into what may be very interesting rational arguments, but which don't really bear any relation to what God has said. Do you see the issue? Now, I actually think with Anselm it's quite a good word. It's quite interesting, worth a read. But these kind of issues, I'm flagging up because they rear up again next week in terms of medieval theology, and they're also feed into the Reformation, okay, and Scholasticism. So that's why I'm flagging them up now. So that just how it ends, Book 2, Chapter 22, how the truth of the Old and New Testament is shown in the things that have been said. Boso, all things which you have said seem to me reasonable and incontrovertible. And by the solution of the single question proposed, do I see the truth of all that is contained in the Old and New Testament? It's always good when you can write the words of the person you're asking a question, doesn't it? For in proving that God became man by necessity, leaving out what was taken from the Bible, this, the remarks on the persons of the Trinity and on Adam, you convince both Jews and pagans by the mere force of reason. And the God-man himself originates the New Testament and approves the Old. And as we must acknowledge him to be true, so no one can dissent from anything contained in these books, Anselm, if we've said anything that needs correction, I'm willing to make the correction if it be a reasonable one. But if the conclusions that we have arrived at by reason seem confirmed by the testimony of the truth, then ought we to attribute it not to ourselves, but to God, who is blessed forever. Amen. So interesting things going on there. On the one hand, Anselm is saying, well, hopefully this is a useful argument, and it's only a useful argument if it ultimately fits in with the testimony of the truth that we get from the Scriptures. On the other hand, he's saying, haven't we done well running this argument purely by reason that both Jews and pagans can assent to by the mere force of reason? So which is it? Do you see the issue? Is it possible to produce a compelling argument through reason and leave the Scriptures to one side? Is that a desirable thing to do? Or is that potentially unwise? And even this, in Anselm's case, you end up with what's actually quite a helpful, although not sufficient, understanding of the atonement, that the necessity for Jesus to be God and man. Any thoughts? Is that just a little bit too much at 9:25 on a Thursday evening? Well, don't worry about it, because I'm planting this thought because we will come back to this question again when we look at Aquinas and sort of teasing out where does this all fit together. The continuing relevance of this for us is in the realm of apologetics, isn't it? What kind of arguments do we deploy when we're seeking to understand and persuade people the truths of the Christian faith? So there's a strong strand of 20th century apologetics which is evidentialist. That is, it says, look, you've got, you know, the Frank Morrison who moved the stone, okay? You know, you've got a gathering together of massive amounts. It's not quite exactly the same, but I think there is a parallel. You get gathering together of massive amounts of evidence to say, look, this is the most plausible explanation. Now, I'm not saying that Frank Morrison ever wants to leave the Bible behind, but, you know, the evidence, is it the evidence that convicts, or is it actually something else that ultimately persuades people to come to Christ? That is, the other way of looking at it, presuppositionalist, is to say, look, we just need to be honest and say, look, let's just follow me with a thought experiment at least. Let's say God is real and he created everything and he sent his son Jesus Christ. Let's hear what he says. So you actually say, no, we can't afford to do, reason won't get us there. It will get us into a model. We need to get people to know who Jesus is and present him. So I just think these are, you know, this is not just an academic 11th century question. This is I think it relates to how we think about what it is that we're doing today. You know, how quickly do we need to get the Bible out when we're talking to people about Jesus? Can we afford to spend time in the other kind of discussions that you have about, you know, creation or evolution or whether the documents have changed or whether the church invented the Bible or what, you know, all these other things that come up. How much of that do you need to answer and how much do you say, look, put that to one side. Let's have a look at John's Gospel together. I'm not sure it's a very straightforward question to answer, is it? But it's one that's worthy of reflection. See, it's not just interesting 11th century stuff. It's also relevant to today. Any questions, observations, thoughts? There are, 28 people all willing, no one to ask a question so they can go home. Let's stop there then. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
See you next time.